All righty, the Board of Public Works meeting is now called to order. May we have a roll call, please?
Joel Clausius,
Present.
Harold Cleams,
Present.
Alder Uguer,
Present.
Alder Conklin.
Present.
I do not see Lisa Stern, and we do know Aaron Williams is excused now, and Michael Cullen.
I'm here. All righty, we got one public hearing scheduled for this evening at 5:30. Do any board members wish to make any disclosures or recusals regarding items on the agenda this evening? Hearing or seeing none. Do we have anybody registered to make public comment for items not on the agenda?
We do not.
Ready. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of the meeting from August the 28th?
Move for approval.
Second.
Got a motion with a second. Do we have any objections? Hearing or seeing none, motion is approved by unanimous consent. There are no items on the agenda this evening that require permits for potential water resources impacts. The consent agenda includes items 8, 10 through 15, and number 17. Any board members wish to break any of those items out for further discussion? If not, do we have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Move approval of consent agenda.
Second.
Got a motion with a second. Do we have any objections? Hearing or seeing none, motion is approved by unanimous consent. All righty. Item number six. This got moved around. Do we have any appeals regarding pre-qualifications of contractors?
We do not.
All righty. Item number seven. We've got
I'd like to make a motion.
Yes.
Can we please re move this to next in 2 weeks' agenda, which would be September 25th agenda?
All right. Got a motion to move item number seven to next meeting for the Board of Public Works in 2 weeks.
Second.
Got a motion with a second. Do we have any objections? Hearing or seeing none, motion's approved by unanimous consent. Item number nine, we got Greg Fries to talk about amending Madison General Ordinances to regarding soil infiltration.
Good afternoon, everybody. Okay, and I see Alder, did you want to preface this, or do you want me to roll into this? What would you like?
I could, I'm trying to think. I have some background I can give for this. Why don't I do that? It'll give a little background and I can make the motion later. So I introduced the first draft of this amendment to Chapter 37, the Stormwater Ordinance, to solve a real problem that was not envisioned when Chapter 37 was overhauled in the wake of the 2018 flood event. At least in my opinion, the current version does in fact serve very well in mandating stormwater management systems that provide climate resilience and the protection of public and private property with regard to the runoff that eventually ends up in our rivers and lakes. What we learned recently was that the ordinance did not provide as much guidance to developers as we would like with regard to infiltration systems, which could increase the risk of damage to adjoining properties compared to the pre-development risk, depending on their design. To be specific, the issue arose with regard to a redevelopment proposed by Stonehouse Development for a property on Old Sauk Road, calling for a three-story apartment building. This is a very large single family, or very largely a single family neighborhood, and the residents organized a vociferous campaign to prevent the development. There were a range of objections, some very familiar around increasing density, and one that had some traction was managing stormwater. It is, in fact, it's a very problematic site, and responding to neighborhood concerns, Stonehouse, in a very unusual move, prior to approval of a conditional use permit, circulated a stormwater plan and then even improved that plan prior to a planned commission decision. And those plans, while generally observant of Chapter 37, included a solution which utilized underground infiltration systems that seemed to pose an increased risk for several neighboring properties that already were dealing with groundwater issues. Ultimately, the Planning Commission and Common Council approved demolition and conditional use permits and rezoning. And I guess I would say that my support for the project has earned me the enduring enmity from the neighborhood, which, if we took some of the comments literally, will extend into the hereafter. Nevertheless, I felt strongly that we should not increase stormwater risks for neighbors. And those immediate neighbors did bring suit to overturn the rezoning and conditional use permit, specifically citing the infiltration risks. Greg Fries and I met after the Common Council rejected an appeal of the conditional use permit before the suit was filed, to talk about what could be done to protect those immediate neighbors. One conclusion was that the intent of the current version of Chapter 37 might be sufficient to justify a rejection of stormwater management plans that posed a significant risk to neighbors. And in fact, I relayed to the developer my support for engineering taking that position. But we agreed that a better long-term solution was to amend the ordinance to provide more guidance with regard to infiltration systems. So why are we now looking at and working on a second substitute? Greg, the storm engineering staff that participated in the clerk's office, and I were focused on the risks of infiltration systems for infill developments and inadvertently missed the difficulties the original version might create for large-scale developments. And I want to thank Bill Connors. I think he's registered and with us today to bring those potential problems to our attention and facilitating multiple discussions with the stormwater engineering community here in southern Wisconsin. It took us to a second substitute to get the appropriate definitions and clarifications, but there it is. So while this amendment was motivated by a specific situation, but it's one that will undoubtedly occur elsewhere, considering the general nature of Madison soils. And that's the background. Maybe Greg, you want to provide a little more technical background for that.
I appreciate that. That was a really good summary. Thank you. Far better than I would have given. So I would only say that the second revision, or that your second substitute, I should say, that you have before you here, really narrows the scope. The missing of the forest for the trees a bit, totally myself and my group's miss on this. We were very focused on the particular site that spurred this revision to the ordinance, and kind of got a little myopic in terms of the changes we were making and how they might affect other developments. So that was certainly an oversight on our part. And so we've had multiple discussions, including one just this morning, on these issues. And I feel pretty good that the revisions now are hitting their intended mark, as opposed to creating some unintended consequences that the first original and the first substitute might have done, probably certainly would have done. So I think last I heard, everybody that we had corresponded with and discussed this with were good. And basically what this does, and in fairness to Stonehouse, they have made these revisions, even though they would not be subject to them. The date of action on this is now April 1st, 2025. So if you have a plan in process already, you're not subject to these. Even if the council adopts them at the next council meeting, they don't go into effect till April 1st. To their credit, Stonehouse has already made changes to their plan that would comply with these standards. So, target completed, right? That was kind of why these were drafted, and they have done that. So kudos to them. I think that's all I have, unless anybody has questions.
So what are we talking about here, Greg? What, in a summary, what is the change? Why? What was it originally, and what is it now?
So if you look at the second amendment or the second substitute, basically what it says in English terms is, if you have good soils, and for infiltration, good soils is really can be defined as sand on your site. And there's a lot of ands here, and it doesn't cause, and to get to those soils doesn't cause you to do something that is in conflict with another ordinance. So one of the things that came up a great deal, and I understand this concern, is that planning prefers to have buildings now front on the right of way. They prefer to have the parking behind the structure. Right. And that is how they prefer things to be developed. Right. And so if that requirement comes in, but it turns out the sand on the site that I is ideal for infiltration is right where the planning says the building has to be. Planning wins. This ordinance doesn't say, well, you have to go back and argue with planning about moving. Right. I'm kind of lowest on the pecking order here in terms of enforcement of this code. We are subservient to other codes, but assuming that this is not in conflict with other codes and you have sand available and you have basically poor infiltration soils, which would be silts or silt loams, you don't have to pump, right? As long as I don't have to make you pump to do this. So there's, like I said, there's a lot of and buts in this, the way this is interpreted. You got to use the sand if you can. And that is really intended for the long-term survivability of these infiltration basins. In the case of Stonehouse particularly, and as I've said, they've already revised their plan, they were putting underground infiltration under their parking lot. Okay, so they used basically what looked like a series of Quonset huts snaked back and forth, sitting on an open graded base of gravel. And you run water into this, and then it fills up the Quonset huts that are under the pavement and then soaks in. Underneath the gravel, though, was a silt loam soil, which is not the greatest. 150 feet away-ish, they had sand available at essentially the same elevation. So what we really wanted them to do, and again, they did, is we wanted to have the ability to say, you know what, let's not build something that is, we are pretty confident is going to have a high expectation of failure in a relatively short amount of time. Let's, you know, do the, what I would call the right engineering thing here and move the system 150 feet and put it in the sand. That is basically what this ordinance says, is you got to use good engineering practice. So to put this in a little historical context, which is probably more than you asked, on a private site, engineering's general approach to this has been over the years, it's your site. We will tell you if you are not doing what I would call best practice for engineering, but if you can make the calculations work responsibly, right, we will approve your design, even though we think it's not the greatest, right? It's your design, it's your maintenance. And a lot of times the consequences of failure of that are only to the person who is building that design. In this particular case, the consequence of failure was that it harmed other parties. And that was what was really causing what I would call a bit of tension between what we were looking to approve and what the ordinance gave us authority to regulate. So the ordinance basically get this change basically within limits, again, within bounds, no pumping, no overriding other city ordinances, asks you to use good engineering judgment, basically, as opposed to just making it fit where you can make it fit. That's probably the best answer I can give you, Chair.
Okay. Bill Connors has got, something to input here, Bill, or?
Yeah, I just want to point out that the version that Greg is describing is the one that's described as in context. The version two is actually an outdated version. The version two talks about chlorinated soils, and it doesn't have the language in there about conflicts with other you know, standards, other city ordinances. It's actually the last document in the series is the one that Greg is describing.
Okay. Is that how you see it, Greg, or?
I'm not on Legistar right now. I'm looking at
what... I think if I can butt
it's
in.
It's the newest one.
Yeah.
It was the last one. Thank you. Yeah, sorry.
There's a semantic issue here. The first version is the original Legistar entry. The first substitute was what came next.
Oh, okay.
And the second substitute is actually the third and most recent version with the that makes the points. And there's an associated document, one in context, that helps with some of the explanations. But it is the third one, as Bill Connors mentioned.
So if I can just summarize from my own personal use here, if the city deems that there is a potential risk for downstream properties, the city does have the ability to put a halt to the development.
This ordinance, as long as you comply with this ordinance and the other portions of Chapter 37 that apply, would not, as long as you are able to comply with this ordinance, we would approve that this. I'm not sure I'm understanding the question, Chair. I'm sorry.
I guess I'm just wondering if, as long as you comply with this ordinance, at that point, engineering is completely satisfied that there will not be any downstream impacts to property owners.
Well, that would be, I think, a misstatement. But I think mainly because there are impacts that I can't control. In this particular case, there are groundwater impacts. So the consequences that I was worried about that were discussed were that if this infiltration system fails, it floods downstream neighbors, okay? The consequences, the larger consequences that there are no state, county, city rules with regard to are where groundwater goes once it is infiltrated, okay? So I don't have any control of that. In fact, there are no codes that I am aware of at any level that control groundwater. Or what you can infiltrate. In fact, the only code I'm aware of is one from the DNR that says you cannot, by statute, limit where people infiltrate water. It cannot be prohibited, at least under DNR code. So
yeah, I guess I was just speaking in terms of flooding.
If you're talking about surface water flooding, again, I would caution what I say here, because we have flooding in this area before this development started. What I can say is this, with this ordinance and with the changes that they have made already, again, prior to this ordinance being adopted, the likelihood of failure of their system, in my opinion, is significantly reduced, right? Every system has a chance of failure, but they have taken steps to significantly reduce that chance of failure.
But moving forward, you feel pretty confident that this new ordinance will hopefully uh, alleviate the potential for catastrophes, I guess, right?
Well, alleviate the likelihood of system failure, right? Is what I'm really trying to what I'm really trying to do is make sure that we don't have a failure underneath the parking lot where the means of repair involve ripping up the parking lot and rebuilding this, which is incredibly disruptive and incredibly expensive for everyone involved.
And then in terms of the way it's written, you've got to have good soils. Do you define good soils by a percentage of granular material or percolation rates, or how do you define that?
We define it in reverse. Basically, what we say in here in the standard is if you have soils that are better than an unamended loam. Okay, so I'm getting into a little, the weeds here a little bit, but from a DNR perspective, a silt loam is the poorest soil at which they require infiltration. A loam is a slightly better soil. And when I say better, what I mean is it infiltrates a little better. Once you go above a loam, you get into a sand or a sandy loam and then a sand, and then it moves up into gravels and so on and so forth. So the way we define it in the ordinance is basically we say if you have something on your site that is better than a loam soil, that's where you should infiltrate if you can, is the way that is said. And that loam soil is defined in DNR standards that are referenced in our spec or in our ordinance.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, that's clear. Any questions for Greg? Harold, you've got a question.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Thanks, Greg. Big picture, this change in ordinance, do you have a sense of the impact it's going to have on the cost of new development and the timeline for new development? Like, I'm basically trying to understand, is this going to make development more expensive and therefore, have a downstream impact on housing costs? Does it slow things down? Does it speed things up? I think what I'm hearing is, to some extent, you're clarifying things that might make it easier, but I'm not totally sure that's a correct interpretation.
I think for the most part that largely this is not much of an impact at all. The pre-work to determine what soils you have on site and how you go about testing those and checking is all basically laid out in a DNR standard that again is referenced in our ordinance. We aren't asking for any more than what engineers already do, largely. In fact, most engineering sites, including the one that spurred this ordinance change, take way more borings than would be required for me because they have to decide what they need to structurally support their building and they have to, mass balance the site and they got to know what they're cutting and what they're filling and all that kind of stuff. So I think all this really does is give the engineers more information up front. So what I can say is for the development here, this was the most costly way to go about this, right? Because they did a full-on 450-page engineering report that then was redone to try and meet this standard, right? So if they had this information to begin with, they wouldn't have had to do this twice, right? And it's not an insignificant amount of work to do that engineering, all these engineering calcs twice. I can't estimate for the developer, but I'm going to say days probably of engineering work was spent a second time to move their devices to meet, to in theory meet the standard. So from a timeline perspective, I really don't think this makes much difference. In fact, I think you could make an argument that this gives more guidance up front and helps the process.
Thank you.
Alder, you here? Got another?
Yes, just for Greg, you might mention in relation to Commissioner Harold's comment here, you made a comment to the assembled stormwater engineers in a meeting we had that this could actually be helpful even on the large scale developments that we didn't design it for. It gave some additional options. You might mention that because I think it's interesting.
Yeah, so what's being referred to here is with new what I would call cornfield development, new plats. We as an engineering and development community have pretty much a terrible record of getting infiltration devices online functioning. Right now, I think city engineering has something like eight what I will call enforcement cases going on with developers who have built what I would call end of pipe systems, right? So you've seen these, they're very common now. We used to just build one big hole in the ground at the bottom of the hill, pond to treat for sediment. Now we build two holes, one that's wet and then followed by one that is in theory supposed to be dry. And that dry one is the infiltration basin. But the more water you take to an infiltration basin, the more likely it is to fail. So the because you're just overloading the soils. And more importantly, during construction of homes, you're sending all the erosion that occurs, even if you're doing practices on the site, all the unintended erosion that you don't capture goes down and fills in all the holes on that construction site and or in that infiltration basin, excuse me. And so it's pretty well understood from the engineering community. The further up in the watershed I do my infiltration, the better these things function, right? Mass collection and treatment at the bottom of the hill. I don't want to say it's a complete failure, but it's certainly more prone to failure. And so what this would also do, again, I don't think this is a requirement, but it would give developers an opportunity to take advantage of sandy soils up in the watershed to drain especially just the rooftops, right? So if you're just draining, say, an internally drained block of a development and it drains to one area before it goes over the sidewalk and into the storm system, you could put a smaller infiltration basin there that has sand underneath it. Because it's only draining rooftop, it tends to be very clean water. No pretreatment is required. No, you know, it's just, and so you can knock a whole bunch of your requirements off at different places further up the hill. Again, no pumping's required, not, you know, but you have an opportunity to do what I would call a better long-term design. More, you know, I hesitate to use the word sustainable, but I'll call it that because right now our infiltration basins that we're trying to accept, you know, we have something like eight under current orders for the developer to repair before we can even take ownership of them through the development agreements that you see Brenda and Tim bring to the board every other, you know, every other meeting. So that I think it's an opportunity. I'm not saying everybody's going to take advantage of it, but I will say Viridian is particularly positioned to as the both developer and developer of the homes. They control both levers, right? They are controlling site grading. They are also controlling home building. They have probably the best opportunity to take advantage of this of anybody. It was not written for that purpose, but I think they have an opportunity.
All righty, any other questions? Hey, Greg, I got one, just one more. In terms of you've approved projects in the past, obviously, under different ordinances. How many of those projects do you think would have been impacted if you had these new ordinances in place?
I honestly think it's a pretty small percentage. Generally speaking, soil profiles, this is a very unusual site on Old Sauk Road. It's only about 3.5, 4 acres, I think. And they have significantly different soils over a very flat site. It is exceptionally flat. And that's pretty rare, especially on the west side where the soil profiles, at least in this area of the west side, tend to be very routine. Quite honestly, sand in Madison is pretty rare in general. I mean, we have a pretty, unless you get to the as you get to the terminal moraine of the glacier down in the southwest part of the city, geology gets messy and you do find sands and gravels and stuff, but everywhere else, we tend to be pretty routine. Topsoil, silts, clays, and then a bedrock of some type. And so my guess is that, if I had to put a number on it, I would say less than 20% would have been impacted by this.
Okay, thank you. If there are no other questions, do we have a motion?
Move to approve.
Second.
Got a motion with a second. Do we have any objections? Hearing or seeing none, motion is approved by unanimous consent. Thank you, Greg, and thank you, Alder Uguer. All righty. Item number, are we on 16 already? Wow.
I believe so.
So we got Mike Sturm talk about Door Creek Park Shelter.
Sure, and myself. I'll maybe start and then kick it over to Mike. Heidi, do you have the bid opening tab?
I can pull it up. We didn't attach it because of what happened. Let me grab it quick.
Jim, I'm happy to provide a little background if that's.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Great. Thanks. Thank you. Hello, everyone. I'm Mike Sturm. I'm the project manager for the Door Creek Shelter project in Door Creek Park. The project before you is in support of a new shelter building that we're constructing that's under construction right now in Door Creek Park. It's a multi-season, roughly 4,000 square foot parks building that has a reservable community space in it. And the project that we're considering tonight is a fiber project that parks initially thought was going to be a necessary component for the operations of that building. And we have found an alternate and more cost-effective way of managing reservations within the shelter. And at this point, Parks is not pursuing contract award for the project before you. So the long history of it is that the intent for the new building was to provide community reservable space on Masson's far east side. This is similar to like the Tenney Pavilion that's more centrally located within the city. And one of the key pieces of operating the facility was how to provide access for reservations that didn't require folks to come to our downtown office or to our office in Olin Park and pick up a set of keys and then go out to the far east side of Masson. We just recognized that distance was pretty great. And in the early design development of the building, it was identified that we would likely need a city network connection to run a card scan system. And that's the project that's before you is it's to install roughly 6,200 linear feet of fiber out to that building. And when the initial cost estimates were coming in, they were kind of climbing for this work, for the fiber work. And Parks agreed to let the project, but with the understanding that we're also going to kind of continue to see if there was other options for us for managing reservations and building access. And we were able to find another system that's cellular based that didn't require a city network connection. And we actually received confirmation that it was going to from the vendor that everything was going to work basically within a day of the bid opening. So rather than pursue this particular contract at this time, we are going to be utilizing this other system that's much more cost effective from the Parks Division, and it will provide a comparable level of service for folks renting the facility and providing access. So I'm happy to answer any questions at this time.
Mike, how will they gain access to the facility? Do they have like a reader for your cell phone or something, or?
Yeah, we ran a little bit of a pilot on one of our other shelters in Warner just to make sure it worked. And it's keypad hardware that's mounted directly on the door, and it has a deadbolt system. And it's a system that provides a unique code for a particular reservation. So the individuals will get their unique code sent to them as part of their reservation with the online system. And they punch the code in, and it's only valid for the time period of their reservation. And so that removes having to get keys or track cards, et cetera. So that's the system that we've been able to find through a variety of vendors, an application that works with the doors that were specified with the building.
Gotcha. Well, I think this sounds great because I think this was presented a few meetings ago. It just seemed like $500,000 was pretty darn expensive for what you wanted to achieve here. So I think it's great that you did find another system. Harold, you got a question or comment?
Yeah, along those lines. I mean, yes, I agree. I remember this being here and being like, oh yeah, I guess the estimate then was 400,000 and now we're at 500,000. I do want to, like, that new system that you have identified, does that have any ongoing operations costs associated with it? And how would they compare to what you originally had envisioned, just being careful that we're not trading one cost for an ongoing other cost?
Certainly, there's a little bit of an offset here. And well, from a maintenance perspective, for the actual hardware, the door hardware is pretty minimal. We have to keep track of an internal battery. But we're already kind of doing that for another shelter, so we know that process, and our facility staff are familiar with kind of marking dates to make sure it's changed out. The other aspect that a network connection would have provided is that it would allow our facility staff to monitor building systems remotely. But the building does have an operations bay in it, so we do see that staff will be on site quite frequently, so they'll be able to simply to monitor things as they traditionally do. You plug a laptop into the building systems software, and you can kind of check building systems that way. So it wasn't really a necessary component, the remote monitoring of the building systems, but it would have been a potential benefit. But at this point, recognizing we'll have staff on site, we don't see it as a large operational burden.
All right, any other questions for Mike on this one?
So I think a quick clarification, a recommendation here would be to reject all bids on this one if somebody is looking to make a motion.
Very good. There's no further questions. Do we have a motion to essentially reject all bids?
I'll make that motion, but question then, you need a referral on this to down the road, or just reject it for right now, Mike, on here?
That is a great question. As far as a referral back to council, I don't know if it will proceed to council if we reject all bids. My understanding is it would not move on to council.
It is actually something we have clarified since, and it does go to council.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
All right, well then, I'll just make a motion. We reject all bids this time.
Second.
Got a motion with a second. Do we have any objections? Hearing or seeing none, motion is approved by unanimous consent. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
All righty. We've got 5:10. We've got a public hearing scheduled for 5:30. So we're going to need a motion to take a recess here.
I'll make the motion to recess until 5:25.
Well, you're going to bring us back early, are you?
Oh, well, whatever you guys want.
I'll second that.
All righty, we got a motion with a second. Do we have any objections? All righty, we'll see everybody at 5:25. All righty. The Board of Public Works meeting is now re-adjourned. May we have a roll call, please?
Joel Clausius?
Present.
Lisa Stern?
Present.
Alder Conklin?
Present.
Alder Uguer?
Present.
Harold Cleams?
Present.
Michael Cullen?
I'm here.
And Aaron is excused.
We've got more people now than we started out with. That's always good, I guess. Are we able to start the presentation before 5:30 here, Jim?
Sadly, we are not. Just in case we get a last-minute registrant.
At this time, we don't have any, but just in case, yeah.
All right. Just curious.
Maybe get his presentation materials loaded up and ready to go, though.
Yeah, that would be prudent.
I would be happy to.
How you doing there, Kyle?
I'm good. Yourself?
Good.
Good.
Waiting anxiously for your presentation.
I
heard
bet.
So much about it. Jim's been talking it up.
Say, hopefully it lives up to the hype.
You're just curious, how many people are interested in going to this special tour of the rapid bus transfer system tomorrow?
What time is that?
I think it's at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Most of us have already gone on this board already. Most of us have already did it.
What do you mean, most of us?
Harold, me, Alder Uguer.
That's not most yet.
That's pretty close to most.
I think we would highly recommend it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I loved it. I would go again if I could.
I thought maybe you were going for a second time.
Sadly, I have to work.
Yeah. I'd like to go, Michael, but I do have a conflict tomorrow. So.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully, there'll be another one sometime.
Well, there'll be buses running all the time.
Right. There'll be buses before you probably get another one.
Is that September 22nd coming up?
Yep. Right.
Okay, 5:30.
All righty. It being 5:30, let's go to the public presentation. We've got Kyle Frank to talk about establishing a sewer improvement impact fee.
Yes. Good evening. Resolution here for you, for the public hearing here, is to create a section of the within the Madison General Ordinance to establish the Pumpkin Hollow Neighborhood Sanitary Sewer Improvement Impact Fee District. With the tongue tire.
Really fast.
Yeah, I don't know if I could. So we're looking to do here is basically establish an impact fee district that would allow us to construct a regional interceptor sewer out on the northeast side of Madison. So it'll give you a little idea of where we are. I have a map here. So this kind of western edge here is the interstate I-90, 94 here. And then this northern north-south running street here is Portage Road. And then Hepker Road runs east-west here. And those kind of make up the center of the district itself. We do have some more properties and land that's part of the district out to northeast here. But essentially, it encompasses kind of this neighborhood out on the far northeast side of Madison. And so with the impact fee district, what we're looking to do is with future development coming into this neighborhood, we're looking to basically construct and extend a regional interceptor that would be able to serve the needs of any development coming into this district. And one way we look to finance this is through an impact fee where essentially we spread the costs out to the developable lots throughout the entire district. And those get added as basically a connection fee when a certain property or a lot is going through the building permitting phase. So what we did is we took in looked at the amount of developable land in the district itself, and we came up with a cost estimate for what it would take to extend that regional interceptor. And we basically weighted that out over the developer land within the district itself. And what that kind of came out to then is we applied a fee on a square foot basis for a lot. And those two fees are not really two fees. The rate came out to about $60.60 per 100 or 1,000 square feet, which then would be $2,639.68 per acre. But what that really translates to is on an average single family home lot, which is about 6,000 square feet, there'd be an additional charge for when that building permit comes in of $363.60 as a connection charge. One thing to note is this impact fee would just be for this regional sewer. So that doesn't mean when a developer comes in that this impact fee pays for any localized sewer that's needed to serve a certain development or plat or whatever. So that would still be the requirement of a developer to build that local sewer to serve their own individual property. This fee would just be to finance the construction of that regional interceptor. That's basically it in a nutshell for what I got. I'll open up to questions.
Boy, after all that hype, Kyle, that was kind of disappointing.
It's a very exciting topic.
Harold, you've got a question or comment.
Yeah, it's mostly exciting. How do the impact fee district boundaries get set? Is that based on a neighborhood plan? I mean, you know, it hasn't sometimes awkward. I mean, some of the boundaries are always following the interstate, but some of them are like, oh, you're excluding some pieces, but not others. So I'm just curious how those boundaries are being set.
Yep. So a lot of it is actually mainly based on drainage basins. So it's what's going to be served by gravity down to this interceptor. On the map I had, we did lay out some additional areas that are not part of the district that could potentially still flow here. If a local lift station was put in, it could potentially come here. If that was to happen, I believe it would reopen the district and extend it to include those. But for right now, the district was basically set on what could drain here based on the drainage area for the sewer.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Hey, Kyle, what do these impact fees get adjusted once the interceptor's constructed? If the, you know, say for instance, it costs more to do it than what you had estimated?
It typically does not. I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe it could be. Let's say it came in unreasonably high above what our estimate and what our fees would. I think we can reopen or basically revise that general ordinance coming back to the board to approve that and to alter it. I'm not 100% sure, but I think that is possible. I don't know if Jim maybe knows more. Otherwise, I can find out for you and let you know. But I believe it can be revised afterwards if need be.
Seems appropriate that that would be the case.
Yes, but I think to date we haven't had to do that.
Just because they've come in under the estimate, or?
Yeah, typically. Or there's enough development opportunity and things that we can recover the costs of the impact fee within a reasonable time frame.
And then how do you handle this? Like Kyle was suggesting that there's another area that may come in if they were to pump up to this area. If you add on in the future areas that weren't originally in the defined area, do they still get assessed that same impact fee?
Not without amending the impact fee district. So I think we could amend it and then you would see Kyle again.
And then essentially you'd be getting money in addition to what it costs to put the interceptor in then, right?
Correct.
Which would be a good thing in one respect.
So theoretically, the way these impact fee districts work is we continue to collect the fees as development happens in this area. And then either everything develops and we've actually collected more fee than what the project cost, and then we would redistribute it, or development slows and we've recovered the costs, and then we just close the impact fee district. And that would theoretically allow a possibility for some folks to connect into this area in the future that didn't pay into the fee.
Which kind of makes it seem...
You would hope everybody pays into the impact fee district.
Right.
We're kind of operating under some state law requirements for how these things have to be opened and closed.
Right. All righty. If there are no questions for Kyle at this point, we'll open up the public hearing. And do we have anybody registered to speak, Heidi?
We do not.
All righty. Then we'll close the public hearing. And one last chance to ask Kyle any questions, any comments. If not, do we have a motion to approve?
Move approval.
Second.
Got a motion with a second. Do we have any objections? Hearing or seeing none, motion is approved by unanimous consent. Thank you so much for this very entertaining and informative presentation, Kyle.
You are very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Have a nice evening.
You too.
All righty. I think that brings us to the end. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
Move for approval. To adjourn. Approval to adjourn.
Got a motion with a second. Good night, everybody.
Good night.